talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Rollen, Argus, Akhoisa.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're investigating the resignation of Richard Nixon 50 years ago, the only time an American president has been forced from office in disgrace. And we'll debate what happened and how it reshaped American politics.
I would have preferred to carry through to the finish, whatever the personal agony it would have involved. And my family unanimously urged me to do so. But the interests of the nation must always come before any personal considerations. From the discussions I have had with congressional and other leaders, I have concluded that because of the Watergate matter, I might not have the support of the Congress that I would consider necessary to back the very difficult decisions and carry out the duties of this office in the way the interests of the nation will require. I have never been a quitter. To leave office before my term is completed is abhorrent to every instinct in my body. But as president, I must put the interests of America first.
You can email us your thoughts and views, talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. In tonight's show, we're looking at the resignation of an American president 50 years ago. On the 8th of August, 1974, President Richard Nixon announced his resignation, effective from noon the following day. The unprecedented move came after mounting evidence of his involvement in the Watergate cover-up, which left him no choice but to step down or be impeached and removed from office. This was the first and only time an American president has been forced from office in disgrace, and it had a profound impact on American politics and public trust in government. And to discuss what happened and why, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Dr. Sandra Scanlon lectures in American history in the UCD School of History and is an expert on American political culture and its relationship with US foreign policy during the Cold War. And she's the author of The Pro-War Movement, Domestic Support for the Vietnam War, and The Making of Modern American Conservatism. Professor Luke A. Nichter is Professor of History and James H. Kavanaugh Endowed Chair in Presidential Studies at Chapman University in California. An expert on the Cold War, the Modern Presidency, and U.S. political and diplomatic history, he's the author of The Year That Broke Politics, Collusion and Chaos in the Presidential Election of 1968. Dr. Sarah Thalen lectures in the Center for the Integration of Research, Teaching and Learning at UCC, an expert on Nixon and the Silent Majority, as well as patriotism and the Nixon White House. Her current research explores the ways that Nixon used patriotic appeals to rally support for his Vietnam War policies. Professor Greg Cumming is resource archivist and staff historian at the Richard Nixon Presidential Library and Museum. Well, you are all very welcome. And Luke, I might begin with you, and I might begin by going just back in time 50 years to this resignation, the only resignation of a sitting American president. Why did Richard Nixon resign?
Well, thank you very much. It's great to be here. I think it's important for listeners to think in 1974 terms, not in 2024 terms. And by that, I mean no president had faced a process like impeachment for over 100 years since Andrew Johnson in the late 1860s for a very minor offense related to a political appointment. And so this was not a situation as we have today, when we're in now a possible impeachment scenario. Every time the House of Representatives is controlled by a political party opposite the president, this was truly a unique and very rare situation. And for Nixon in 1974, it was a question of his support in the Senate. So his impeachment, as we often say, it's not the crime, it's the cover-up, the Watergate break-in. It's been proven he's had no role or knowledge of that whatsoever, as far as based on the available evidence. And it was ultimately the dwindling support, public support for Nixon in his first 2 years of his second presidential term that kept an eye on those votes in the Senate. And it takes 2/3 vote in the Senate to remove a president from office. And I think the highest the Nixon side had whipped at that time is maybe about 26. Now, the Senate had never voted on removing a president before. It's possible a few might have sobered up and realized the serious moment that they were in. But I think looking at the numbers, you needed to get to at least 34 to block impeachment. They were at about 26. So when the Supreme Court in late July of 74 released some White House tapes secretly made of Nixon's conversations that made him look like he had engaged actively in a cover-up of the Watergate scandal, I think his remaining support collapsed. And it was better for Nixon to resign than to fight it out.
And Luke, it's good the way you explain the impeachment process there, because I think there is often confusion about it. You can be impeached by the House, but then you have to be convicted by the Senate. And because it requires, as you say there, the 2/3 majority, it is a high bar to meet. And it didn't happen with the two times Trump was impeached or when Bill Clinton was impeached.
It didn't. And what this shows is you've mentioned two more recent cases. And I think to that, we could add perhaps Reagan and Iran-Contra, not an impeachment any more than Nixon was impeached. I mean, Nixon also got out. But it was a serious situation that could have gone that direction with Reagan. So in 100 years, we'd had no impeachments. And now in 50 years, no matter where you find yourself on the political spectrum, it's been done to your side. And we've effectively normalized a process that was supposed to be exceedingly rare in the founders of this country. And I think, unfortunately, we are in the worst nightmare of those founders going forward, because it is going to become more normal.
Greg, maybe I might ask you the question just in terms of Nixon's character about why he resigned, because before that, he tended to have this fight, win at all costs mentality. Is there a little bit of surprise that he didn't stay and fight it out to the bitter end? And should we give Richard Nixon some credit for resigning rather than continue with that process, be forced out of office and further damage the office of the presidency?
That is a great question. If you look at his resignation speech, he's really talking about the good of the country is why one of the reasons why he's leaving. That it's his instinct to continue to fight all the way through. He's also getting support from his family to fight the allegations, fight the impeachment, stay tough. His daughter Julie leaves a letter for him as this all is rising to the forefront and really at a head on August 6th, saying just give it a couple more weeks. He has influences. But I think the ultimate influence is what Nick mentioned, is the meeting on August 7th where the congressional leaders come into the Oval Office and they lay out a case that there's just not support waiting for him in the House, enough votes in the House to send the impeachment to the Senate. And in that meeting, they're saying that there are only 15 votes in the Senate that can be counted on by Richard Nixon to support him. So by August 7th, he is very cognizant of the fact that the support just isn't there. So he has to make a judgment call. And that decision was, it's time to end the Watergate issues. It was that late summer. And he also had knowledge of the smoking gun tape, and it was just released prior to that, which was really causing all this to happen. But it's that tape that's released that really influenced them. It's time. I've got to go.
And do you think that in a way he was the architect of his own downfall in a number of ways? First, because of the way he was involved in the cover-up, but also it was his paranoid style that made sure that he did record all of these conversations in the White House, and they were the things that caught him in the end.
Well, what I would say is that in regards to the tapes, initially, his predecessor, Lyndon Johnson, told him it's great that you have these tapes, and Nixon's initial instincts are, rip it out, I don't want it in my White House. But he comes back in 1971, has the installation of the tapes. But in doing so, he's looking at his predecessors, Kennedy and Johnson, and they had full control. They leave the White House with the tapes, keeping in mind that at this point in time, the former president, as they leave the White House, they own the papers. They own everything. And in this case, Nixon, his feeling is, I'll own the tapes. I'll just use them for my personal usage, and that they would never see the light of day. So that's one of the interesting aspects of that. He never expected anyone or anticipated anyone ever using or listening to these tapes ever.
Sandra, you've written extensively on Nixon's foreign policy, and in that arena he had some notable successes, like when it came to China, some failures when you could perhaps look at, you know, Vietnam and the escalation there and so on. But his presidency came to be defined by the manner in which he left it, and it ensured that that's how his reputation has been seen largely as, despite some successes, a failure because he's the only president who was ever forced to resign.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think looking at that moment of the resignation, it's not, I think, simply that he's facing this extraordinary legal challenge, which he is. It's also that this is a moment in which he has essentially spent, you know, a year at least, if not almost 2 years since the break-in, denying any involvement. He's consistently stated publicly that he knew nothing about this. There was no cover-up. And then you get to that moment when the tapes are released, which he has pushed back really, really hard for over almost a year, saying, we're not releasing these tapes, we're not releasing these tapes, which the public knows are there, the Senate knows are there. The Senate has been calling for these tapes to be released, and he said, there's nothing on them, they're mine, you're not getting them. So this has been going on for a really long time. And then you get to that moment where the tape, the smoking gun, as Greg mentions, is released, and it's really clear that he has been lying from the very beginning. So that's the reason, I think, when you look at the difference in terms of what he did achieve, and many of his achievements were remarkable in both domestic policy and foreign policy. But also it's the fact, the sense that he has lied, that he can't be trusted. And that then, you know, really has an effect on the way in which his foreign policy was interpreted. It's a case of, well, okay, so he may have done some good things in terms of international relations, but what was the motivation behind that? Was it always about his own political agenda? Was he really doing this for the good of the nation? And I think that image has obscured some of the successes that he did have, particularly, as you mentioned, in relation to China and opening up U.S. relations and diplomatic relations with China.
So, Sarah, maybe let's go back in time then to the 1972 election, because he was on course for this landslide victory against McGovern. So it's not entirely clear why the re-election committee felt they had to break into the Democratic Party headquarters and steal materials and try and bug the office and so on. It's not entirely clear why that was viewed as worth doing or even as necessary.
Yeah, and it's a really kind of it's this baffling moment that I think would have, you know, like there's this atmosphere of, you know, ends justify the means. You referenced paranoia earlier. They were leaks, you know, every administration has leaks, but, you know, Nixon and his aides were just really fixated on these leaks. So they brought in this group to kind of get rid of the leaks, find the leaks, ended up calling themselves the plumbers. And, you know, we know that story. And like, to me, it's, they really thought they were doing something that Nixon would be proud of. But when you sort of, you have that comment from Nixon where he's like, there's nothing in the DNC, like that's not where the important things are. So it's kind of this baffling moment that they didn't need to do it. But I think they were so caught up in their own view. And like, this was for some people, their way in, like their way to get the president's loyalty. If they could get something great from these bugs, that it was worth it. And it, you just sort of have this, they're in, you know, they're seeing the world through that view of everyone is out to undermine us. We have to close it off at every line. Sure, they're probably bugging us, so why shouldn't we bug them? We need to know what they're doing. And it just starts to kind of escalate, and it becomes almost self-justifying as you go, that like, that this is a thing that's happening and has happened and will happen, so we'd better be ahead of it. Even if it maybe doesn't make sense immediately, it's better to do it than not. And you get this sort of, it just becomes really cyclical as they go through. And it's what got Nixon, you know, he wasn't able to get through it. And the needing to cover up, like we've said, you know, it's that cover up that really kind of pulls the larger administration in. Because initially this was in the campaign offices. This wasn't the White House, but they had lots of ties and lots of overlap between them. So
And Sarah, why do you think he authorised the cover-up? And I've heard some of the tapes where he says, let's put pressure on the FBI, let's say this is national security and it's to do with the Bay of Pigs in Cuba and so on, and kind of scare them off investigating. But why did he go out of his way to protect those who were involved?
I think there's a couple of things. He knew there's a level that he was aware of. You know, I don't think he knew anything about the planning of this particular incident, but there were dirty tricks throughout the administration, a lot of questionable things that they had done. And Nixon's a very smart man. He knew that as you start to go into these things, more and more and more and more comes out. And I think that it was that fear of exposing that broader collection of things that they had done that, you know, you mentioned when the tapes came out and it was clear he'd been lying, and he has an image to preserve and a story to keep and a narrative to kind of promote. And if all of this other stuff comes out, it will seriously damage it, as we see. But also, like, they can't give an inch. And he just, I think by this point especially, was just constitutionally unable to say, like, okay, this is a problem, that's a bad thing that happened, and we can kind of separate and move on. He just sees everything connected, and it starts to become a lot of, you know, starts to become personal. It starts to threaten his political position, and he just kind of digs in and digs in and digs in. So it just kind of cascades that way, where he just sees, they sort of lose their sense of proportion. And it's like any threat, no matter how small, is just as big as the big, big threats.
Luke, when did the story begin to emerge about the break-in, and when did the suspicions develop about the cover-up? And is there a sense that we have various different people involved? We have the journalists, famously Woodward and Bernstein, who perhaps get more of the share of the credit than perhaps they deserve because they are immortalized in the cinematic accounts and so on. And you have various lawyers involved. But how quickly does it unravel for Nixon and the team?
Well, I suppose there's different ways of looking at it. Taking the broadest possible view, you know, even today, we're still learning dramatic new things about Watergate that we didn't know 50 years ago. 50 years for any complicated historical subject is about how long it takes before all the records are declassified, before everyone's gone from the scene and we have a different perspective. And 50 years later, the history we have today is almost the same as that written by the journalists covering Watergate in the mid-1970s. In just recent years, new records being released by the National Archives are showing all sorts of things, the collusion between the prosecutors in Watergate and judges. The people accusing Nixon of improper conduct were engaging in improper conduct in some cases. So we're learning all sorts of new things. As Sarah mentioned, you know, if I assign my 10-year-old daughter to a school report on Watergate, the first question she would ask is who authorized the break-in? What were they doing there? What were they doing at the time that they were arrested? And these are fundamental questions of Watergate that in 2024 we still don't have the answers to. And this has allowed conspiracy theory to creep into Watergate. Today, I would estimate about 500 hours of Nixon's tapes have never been released before by the National Archives. Millions of pages of records, especially grand jury records, have never been released. So while it seems like after 50 years we ought to have all the answers to the questions, there's still an enormous amount that we don't know. At the time, in 1972, 3, and 4, the public's knowledge occurred in drips, drips at a time. Watergate, the break-in was in June of 72. It wasn't much of a story except for inside the Washington, D.C. Beltway in 72. In September, you know, the trial against the burglars for breaking and entering was going on kind of behind the scenes of an election year, which dominates the news, as we know. And then it really wasn't until 73 when questions about the White House statements before about no involvement on the part of White House staff in Watergate were beginning to be challenged. A few of the burglars who were arrested and in jail who had maintained their silence were beginning to talk and suggest that higher-ups might have been involved. And ultimately, I think the biggest break of all was when White House counsel John Dean switches sides and begins to cooperate with prosecutors in exchange for his own personal immunity and begins to give his dramatic testimony in June of 1973, where he argues there was a broader conspiracy that connected that built the bridge that was needed to make the link between the campaign offices, as Sarah pointed out, and the White House. And at that point, Watergate was a serious crisis, not just for Nixon's campaign, but for the White House itself.
And Luke, at the same time as all of this is going on, the vice president of the United States has to be replaced because Spiro Agnew is caught up in charges of money laundering and tax evasion. So the person who had been on the ticket both in 1968 and 1972 is removed and Gerald Ford becomes vice president.
Well, that's exactly right. And I think if you were to ask the average person on the street if they knew anything about Watergate at all, and if they knew anything about Spiro Agnew's resignation, they would assume that was part of Watergate, too. And so it creates this sort of climate that, you know, all these things were going on at the same time. They must have been connected somehow. And I think that's how people consumed, you know, this information. And only, very recently, are we beginning to more dispassionately look at these details and figure out, well, what really happened and what led from A to B to C? And even in the case of the smoking gun tape, John Dean, in his latest book in 2014 about Watergate, now says we've misunderstood this tape all along, that Nixon and Haldeman were not discussing stopping the FBI investigation of Watergate. That was the obstruction of justice, the most serious thing that they really got on Nixon in terms of the impeachment in the House. In fact, they were talking about not interviewing two Democratic donors to Nixon's campaign. They were talking about obstructing, to use that word, you know, something smaller. And so I think 50 years later, you know, there's a lot of questions. You know, how should we consider Watergate in this era of impeachment? How should I teach it to my students who are 18, 19, and 20 years old? Should I teach it the way that people learned it at the time and then now add in all that we've learned since? Or it's very challenging for young people to understand because it's complex, there's lots of characters, and we're still learning dramatic new things.
Sandra, there is an irony there in that Nixon had campaigned very heavily on a law and order platform, and that was such a crucial part of his political identity. And then to have all of this going on in the background really was very much at odds with that.
Yeah, absolutely. In 1968, Nixon had really tried to set himself as you know, above the sort of democratic chaos. The 1968 Democratic convention, like the one this year, took place in Chicago, and it was a scene of, you know, rioting and protest both outside the convention hall, but also chaos with inside the convention hall. So it was, you know, really useful for the Democrats, sorry, the Republicans, to be able to present themselves, and Nixon in particular, as being opposed to that kind of chaos. So law and order was, in many respects, it was a euphemism for opposition to civil rights, opposition to the kind of protest that was taking place in American cities against police oppression and so forth. But in the American imagination, the mainstream imagination, there was this sense that Nixon, for all the sort of, you know, tricky dicky image that he had, was, you know, hard line when it came to, you know, sort of international relations, but also hard line when it came to dealing with crime. And I think that is partly one of the surprises that came for many people. You know, they did believe him when he said that he, you know, famously said, "I'm not a crook. I didn't do this. I would not be responsible for this. You know, you may not think that I'm the most photogenic or, you know, pleasant president, but I'm not a crook. I'm not a liar." And that's why, in some ways, when a lot of this information started to come out, you know, over such a long period, so people were really sick to death of Watergate by the time Nixon resigned. But there was this sense of, oh, so maybe all of these ideas of him being kind of, you know, tricky-dicky are in fact accurate, and he's not the upstanding person that he's presented himself as being, and that many, many Americans really subscribed to. They did, you know, they did. He was very popular in 1968. He won the election that year, obviously, but he did also, you know, really, I think that 1968 was a key moment in that transition from the kind of liberal consensus concept that people have about sort of the 40s and 50s into this new era. So there's this sense that, you know, yes, absolutely, that this idea that he was this law and order candidate, and then to be somebody who's brought down by, you know, not simply by breaking the law, but by doing it in such a way that, as Sarah pointed out, just seemed so unnecessary, that he was popular. He won the election in 1972 by a landslide. There was a sense of, why do this thing that seems so unnecessary?
And Greg, that really does get to the heart of it, doesn't it? That here you have someone who has talent and ability as a president, who is skilled in foreign policy and diplomacy, and has great insight into world affairs, is doing some things very well as president, and then has this Shakespearean fatal flaw that is undermining the presidency from the beginning and which proves to be the fatal flaw that leads to his downfall.
He's an interesting character because if you look at Nixon's career, his failure to be elected governor in 1962 after losing a very close election in 1960 to John F. Kennedy, his career as a politician was thought to be over. There's the famous television program, I believe on ABC, The Political Obituary of Richard Nixon, that came out in 1963. So his career is seemingly over. But yet, by 1968, he rises again, becomes a Republican nominee, and eventually the president. Here's a man, he has a duality of character. He has his highs and he has his lows, and that's what you always see within his career. I guess the one character we can look back and say that Nixon had a definite large amount of was resiliency. But you see that within his administration, that there are times when secrecy, we look back, secrecy was a key issue. Whether we're talking about the bombing issue in Cambodia or the negotiations with the Chinese to take his trip, John Conyers, a congressman during these years, once said that the secrecy was what helped create the mindset that led directly to the Watergate conduct. So you see the highs and lows of Richard Nixon. He can oftentimes be the most magnanimous individual, but there were also lows, like his reaction to the release of the Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers. So you see these highs and lows throughout his career, and that's just what typified and maybe in some respects led to popularity amongst the people regarding Richard Nixon, because he succeeded and failed just like the average American.
And Greg, just on that point of the Pentagon Papers, the papers that Daniel Ellsberg leaked and that created such controversy and contributed to Nixon's paranoia and desire to cut out leaks and preserve secrecy. But given that those papers were so damaging to various Democratic presidents because it exposed what they were involved with in terms of Vietnam and misleading the American public, should he have been that upset given that it was Democrats who were being damaged and not his own presidency?
You're absolutely correct on that. There is nothing in terms of the material that was involved. No. Now, where it got into this controversy was Henry Kissinger weighing in, saying that the release of our national secrets and things of that nature, that could cause a great deal of difficulty in negotiations, future negotiations. So in essence, it's Henry Kissinger that drives this desire to do something about the release of the Pentagon Papers, and initially not so much Nixon.
Well, tonight we are talking about the resignation of Richard Nixon 50 years ago and the events that led to his downfall. We'll take a quick break now, and when we come back, we'll find out about the appointment of a special prosecutor and how the firing of that special prosecutor a few months later in the infamous Saturday Night Massacre contributed to the downfall of Richard Nixon. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we are talking about the resignation of Richard Nixon 50 years ago. My panel of experts, Dr. Sandra Scanlon of UCD, Professor Luke Nichter of Chapman University in California, Dr. Sarah Thalen of UCC, and Professor Greg Cumming of the Richard Nixon Presidential Library and Museum. Luke, can we talk about the appointment of the special prosecutor Archibald Cox by the Attorney General? Why was a special prosecutor appointed, and why did that make things much more difficult for the Nixon White House?
Well, the appointment of a special prosecutor remains controversial today as it was then. I think the idea back then was that Watergate, while many presidencies are involved in scandals and alleged scandals at some point, that Watergate was beyond just the typical scandal. It couldn't be either investigated within the normal course of office business within the U.S. Attorney's Office in Washington, D.C., and Nixon himself couldn't prepare a proper defense using his own, you know, regular staff people. And the idea of bringing in special counsel were involved. So I think anytime a crisis reaches a certain threshold, there's talk of a special prosecutor. And this remains controversial because, you know, I think today we assume the president has the power to appoint virtually anyone and fire almost anyone. They serve at the pleasure of a president. But back then, that idea was not really tested. If you try to discipline a special prosecutor, it looks like you're trying to interfere in their investigation. Back then, a special prosecutor, I think many Americans considered him to be neutral, and his staff were simply seeking the truth. And I think even the constitutionality of a special prosecutor today is questioned. So I think we reached a certain point in 1973 the severity of Watergate had reached a certain point that a special prosecutor was needed. But I think that was really the beginning of the trouble for Nixon, because it's very difficult for a president. I mean, you could ask Bill Clinton if he were here on the panel, you know, how difficult it is to work under those conditions. And to know kind of what's proper in that environment. And we've had several even in recent years. And you know, it's awkward for the sitting president to work closely together. And it's not clear who the special prosecutor works for either.
And then as it went into the fall, into the autumn, Nixon's White House attempted to order Cox to drop his subpoena to get these White House tapes. Cox refused. And then Richard Nixon ordered his attorney general to fire Cox. He refused and resigned. He asked the assistant attorney general to do it. He refused and resigned. And it ended up being Robert Bork, the solicitor general, who then sacked Cox. And this became known as the Saturday Night Massacre.
That's right. You've got the timetable there just right. And within about 10 days, that becomes a serious problem for Nixon. Within by the very end of this is October of 1973. And by the end of that month now, we have the beginning of talk of impeachment in the House of Representatives, and Nixon's now, you know, he's got about 9-10 more months in office, and that would be the new focus of the investigation, is moving toward a potential impeachment in the House of Representatives during Nixon's remaining time in office.
And Sarah, while all of this is going on, you also have the Watergate hearings. Tell me about those hearings and how impactful they were, and I suppose how American citizens were learning about this scandal from the hearings.
Yeah, I mean, it was a really powerful moment. They were televised. It was covered really heavily. And for a lot of, sorry, you know, outside the Beltway, your regular citizens, this was kind of their first glimpse of the kind of inner workings of their government. And it really, as you know, story after story comes out, it really starts to undermine a lot of the kind of really broad trust that had existed. And once that starts to chip away and you have all of these other things happening, these things that previously seemed impossible, the idea that, you know, Luke mentioned how it was so unusual. So it'd been so long, 100 years since an impeachment. It starts to become like, oh, you know, these things happened and they're not what they present themselves as. And it just starts chipping and chipping away. But it also starts closing that net around Nixon and his core loyalists, because it's who is going to come next. And it starts to really amp up that kind of, if you're not with us, you're against us mentality in the White House. That again just kind of intensifies everything, and it just builds and builds.
Sandra, what really surprises me about the story is that Nixon wasn't able to rely on his own Republican hardliners to back him up on it. That you think about how partisan and polarized and extreme things are now, that, you know, sometimes they're prepared to back their person right or wrong, and no matter how wrong it is, they will find right in it. But that wasn't the case in 1973 and 1974, because Nixon did try and rally support from his Republican colleagues, and they didn't want to back him.
Yeah, I mean, we're looking at a time when the parties were far less sort of partisan, if you will, certainly in terms of political terms. You still had liberal Republicans. That seems like kind of a crazy concept these days. So I think part of Watergate and part of Vietnam was that change in the way in which the parties operated. So the Democratic Party became, you know, vastly more liberal in terms of its response to civil rights and so forth. And the Republican Party, in turn, became much more conservative. So you do have that division within the party. Nixon had never had a very good relationship with Congress to begin with. So he had wanted to control things very much from within the White House. And that was particularly the case with foreign policy, where he, you know, gave very little connection with Congress. Sorry, wasn't listening to what Congress was saying about foreign policy. And, you know, we saw that changing, particularly after the 1972 elections, when you had, you know, huge numbers of people in the wake of kind of the ending of Vietnam. We saw a huge number of more liberal people elected to Congress. So that relationship is not very effective on a practical level to begin with. I think Republicans in Congress would feel that Nixon wasn't really even listening to them. When it came, however, to that point where, you know, congressional leadership and Barry Goldwater went to him the day before the resignation, in many respects, they have been kind of, you know, lauded as heroes who went to the president and said, look, the game is up. It's finished. You know, you have to resign for the good of the nation and so forth. Even Barry Goldwater and John Rhodes in their memoirs said, we didn't actually, you know, try to convince him to resign. We just discussed the way things were. And as we heard at the beginning of our conversation today, it was already clear at that point that Nixon was not going to have support in Congress to be able to withstand a Senate conviction. So really what they were saying there was, this is the situation. And Barry Goldwater stated afterward, who was a very strong supporter of Nixon, had been right back since 1964 when Nixon supported his campaign for president so strongly, even when other Republicans were opposed to Goldwater. So there's a close relationship, you know, a fairly close bond there. And even he said that it was very clear at that point that Nixon understood that he was going to have to resign rather than face the whole process of going through any kind of Senate conviction.
And Craig, you do see the net closing in around Richard Nixon then, and he's forced to release these tapes. And talk to me about the significance of that, and talk to me about the way they didn't want any swearing to be made public, so an expletive deleted was included in it. And it all just seemed to unravel then for Nixon after that.
Absolutely. The key is to remember that he never expected anyone to listen to these. So there's the theory that also that he would sometimes, because his voice activated, forget that he was being taped himself. His Quaker background also played a part in why he didn't want anybody to know that he was swearing. The feeling that he would disappoint many people, that the swearing was unpresidential, that all played a part in that release, because the White House tapes were actually released in these paperback books that were widely, I have one of the originals, and they're widely available for less than $2. I mean, so anybody who wanted had access to them. But it's the fact that these tapes got out. They, like I said, he never imagined that they would be released to the public. There was never the thought that Butterfield in the summer of 73 what announced to the Senate when he was being interrogated that they existed. There are very few people that knew about it. So the whole process that it becomes an issue that these exist, and the whole idea of these tapes existing without the tapes, if the tapes were never released, never revealed, it's hard for me to imagine that there would have been a process by which the House could impeach Richard Nixon, and that the Senate would even have thought about impeaching him. It was just convicting him. There's just, I can't see that happening. So the tapes play the key role, and it's that smoking gun tape in particular of June 23rd, 1972, that is the key moment that everybody grabbed onto, saying the guilt for the cover-up.
And Craig, it was very emotional then when he did make that decision to resign. There was a televised broadcast to the nation then, his resignation speech the evening of the 8th of August. But then his farewell speech in the White House the next day before he departed by helicopter is very powerful. He talks about his mother. He talks about Theodore Roosevelt as a young man. And when he thought the light had gone from his life forever, but he went on, and he went on to serve his country as an ex-president, that there's real emotion in Nixon's voice. There's real, you can see the intensity of it all is getting to him, and he's doing his best to give some kind of message that will support his legacy in the years ahead.
You can see how emotional it is in a couple of ways. If you look in the crowd, as the cameras pan the crowd, the staff that worked for Nixon all those years are in tears. They gave up those years to work in the White House to work for President Richard Nixon. And the speech he gave was, to me, quintessential Richard Nixon. He talked about his background. He called his mother a saint. His father was a hardworking man who did what he could for his family and provided for his family. It really encompasses the emotions that were going through the Nixon White House those last 2 to 3 weeks. And this is sort of that letting go of all that emotion that he had held in. As he said, he felt numb going through the whole process that last day, signing his resignation. He said he was numb to it. He had taken so many barbs, nothing more could hurt him. And so he's sort of letting it all out in that speech, talking about he lived on the poorest lemon ranch in California. Yeah, he's just really personalizing everything he'd gone through. And you get to see, I really think and believe you get an insight into Richard Nixon through that speech. That's absolutely wonderful, in my opinion, his ability to get out his emotions in what has to be one of the toughest moments in any president's career.
Okay, when we come back, we'll be talking about the impact of the resignation and what it meant for American politics. So stay with us here on News Talk.
DR Power Equipment is the industry leader in field and brush mowers. Their full line of machines are designed to clear acres of tough weeds, woody brush, and saplings up to 3 inches thick, hour after hour, year after year. Just one mow, and you'll agree nothing stops a DR. Visit drpower.com to learn more and shop the sale today.
Welcome back. We're talking history, and we're talking tonight about the resignation of Richard Nixon 50 years ago. My panel of experts, Dr. Sandra Scanlon from UCD, Professor Luke Nichter of Chapman University in California, Dr. Sarah Thalen of UCC, and Professor Greg Cumming, the resource archivist at the Richard Nixon Presidential Library and Museum. Luke, can we talk about the impact of the resignation? Because people talk a lot about the United States in the 1970s and that sense of maybe insecurity and uncertainty. Is it caused by the resignation? Is it caused by Vietnam? Is it caused by Watergate itself? What is the cause of that, I suppose, crisis in American confidence?
Well, later in the decade, President Jimmy Carter referred to it as a malaise on America. And that malaise didn't start in the Carter administration. It started some years before. I think the nation was very unsure of itself after the experience in Vietnam. It wasn't clear after civil rights in the 1960s, you know, where what was their path forward to making more progress on that issue. In the 1960s, something was different about that. The younger generation pitted against their parents' generation. And in the midst of that, huge political shifts taking place. Millions of Southern Democrats, one half of FDR's, you know, New Deal coalition formed back in the 1930s. were either split ticket voting for Republicans or were actually becoming Republicans after 1964, most prominently Strom Thurmond changing political parties. So Nixon was really in the eye of the storm. And I think whoever would have been elected in 1968, even had Johnson stayed in the race and not withdrawn, had it been Democrat Herbert Humphrey, I think would have governed over a very difficult period. I think it's important to look that you look at all of the presidents, those contemporaries of Nixon's, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, and Ford, none of them served their full term of office, each for different reasons. This was an exceptionally, you know, historically a time of turbulence and tumult. So I think it, looking at the broader picture, that really sets the landscape for the time period in which Nixon governed, and the resignation itself was again, just like impeachment, unprecedented. From a practical standpoint, we didn't know, you know, could Nixon still be charged for civil or criminal offenses? Then there was the issue of the pardon. I mean, almost every way you look beneath the surface, there's some unprecedented element of it. And I think people were just, were not sure how to cope with this. We'd never seen anything like it before in U.S. politics.
Sandra, maybe let's talk about that pardon then. Gerald Ford becomes president, succeeds Nixon after the resignation, and he makes that decision to pardon Nixon. Some praise that decision because otherwise it wouldn't have helped the United States to heal after that or to come together if you had this very contentious prosecution of a former president. But others say it destroyed Ford's presidency then and cast a shadow over the whole thing.
Yeah, this is one of those situations where you look back and expect to find that there's going to be some great debate and conversation, discussion about should we do this, should we not do it. The reality is that almost from the get-go, Ford was going to pardon Nixon. He was advised by, you know, his aides, by Republicans, that to watch Nixon go through any kind of civil trial, criminal trial, would be something that would be devastating for the Republican Party. It would bring out all of these issues that we talked about earlier that were unknown about Watergate. So the idea that this was going to go on and on for more years of more kind of investigations and so forth was something that really, really the White House had no appetite for. The people had no appetite for this. So the idea that there was any great debate is something that I think is more in retrospect than reality at the time. Ford felt, I feel, very strongly that the nation did need to heal. He was somebody who was, you know, part of that generation where bipartisanship had been part of American politics to a certain extent. And he observed, as we just heard, like that political realignment that was taking place and looked at all the social, cultural divisions that were taking place in the U.S. at the time and saw that any attempt to have a former president who was still at this point, although, you know, there was people who despised Nixon, who thought that, you know, he had really, you know, damaged the presidency, that he was somebody who had, you know, lied about Vietnam, lied about so many issues. Despite all of that, he was still, you know, there was still a great deal of sympathy for Nixon, somebody who had, at the end of the day, had a, you know, pretty, you know, unhappy childhood, lost two of his brothers to tuberculosis. So there was a sense in which this was somebody for whom a lot of Americans had sympathy, and therefore Ford looked at this and it was a case of, we're not going to put that person, a former president, through this kind of trial.
Sarah, do you think that the whole Watergate crisis and controversy and then the resignation of Nixon contributed to a deeper cynicism among the American people, that they were cynical about politics, they were cynical about politicians, and they didn't also trust the people who were leading them?
Oh, I think absolutely. They're, you know, before Nixon, and, you know, it's easy to sort of do these before Nixon and after Nixon, so I don't want to say it's too sharp there, but there was a deep trust in, you know, sort of the system, not the system exactly, but the, you know, like that politicians, and that they were trying, you know, you might think of them individually, their flaws, and be critical, but kind of like there's something to believe in here. They're putting there's a higher good that they're working towards, whatever I may think about, you know, my local politician personally. And as you have this constant disclosure of ways that they were not putting the country first, that they were putting themselves first, they were putting their own careers first. And Sandra mentioned how it was just like this constant drip. It was just constantly coming and coming and coming, and people were sick of it. And that really starts to question things, right? Because Nixon said, you know, I'm not a crook, I'm an honest man, all of that stuff. And then you find him swearing and saying terrible things and covering things up and basically, you know, acting like a crook in a lot of ways. And so you start to have this disconnect between what people thought and what they see. And as you start to see that, and as you experience that, it's easy to say, oh, well, what else isn't what it looks like? What else should I be suspicious of? And so you have that feeding in. And then at the same time, and people have referenced this a little bit, there was so much hope raised and a lot of potential felt in the civil rights movement, the different sort of rights revolutions and protest movements of the 60s, that a lot of them didn't fulfill the expectations of the people who were in them. So you have sort of this coming from both sides, where you have all this cultural and social change that didn't necessarily get all the way there. So a lot of activists start to get very jaded and cynical. And then you have sort of the politics and the government being seen as much more sort of commonplace and questionable. And you kind of have it from both sides, and people start to wonder, you know, like, where is this going and how is it happening? And, you know, is everything what it's cracked up to be? And I think that just starts to feed on itself, because once you start looking for proof of that, like anything, once you start looking for something, it's easy to find it.
Greg, I wonder, when you have so many people visiting the library, how do they view Richard Nixon and how do they view his resignation? And I suppose, how is he perceived now?
That's a great question. The wars of Watergate, to a great extent, I think, have changed public opinion. If you were asking me this question in 1980, I remember going through an airport with Nixon's memoirs and the security person telling me, isn't that a book about a crook? So I had to, I mentioned briefly the nuances. Today, I think you would look at the events of Watergate and the resignation more with sadness instead of this was a purely situation where somebody was corrupt, which was the perception more in the 1970s. The visitors, I think, are very well-disposed to our exhibits. We make sure that our exhibits are non-political, that anybody with any viewpoint can come on in. We have that great Oval Office where you can sit down, and I know many people go behind the replica Wilson desk that Nixon had in the Oval Office and get their pictures taken. The perception is much different than when he first left the White House. I think there's a greater appreciation for some of the things he accomplished, whether it's, you know, going off the gold standard or the opening to China, bringing home the POWs, whatever that might be. The perception is different even after the 1980s. So I think if you're looking at it historically, one could say that the Reagan administration, the Reagan presidency, helped in the rehabilitation of Richard Nixon, because you see it was during the 1980s, Reagan's administration, that you see the cover of Richard Nixon on a magazine saying he's back. So I think he'll be judged more by his policies as we get further away from Watergate.
Well, I think that's an excellent note on which to end our discussion tonight of the resignation of Richard Nixon, the first and only American president to resign from office 50 years ago. My thanks to Dr. Sandra Scanlon of UCD, Professor Luke Nichter of Chapman University, Dr. Sarah Thalen of UCC, and Professor Greg Cumming of the Richard Nixon Presidential Library and Museum. Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Marisa Sullivan, and Peter Malloy on sound. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so hope you can join us then. We've been Talking History. Good night.
DR Power Equipment is the industry leader in field and brush mowers. Their full line of machines are designed to clear acres of tough weeds, woody brush, and saplings up to 3 inches thick, hour after hour, year after year. Just one mow, and you'll agree nothing stops a DR. Visit drpower.com to learn more and shop the sale today.